Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Here and Now. The Federal Reserve is meeting today, which means by the end of the day, money will be a little more expensive. An interest rate hike expected later today will mark the 16th rise over the last 2 years and the highest the rate has climbed since 2002. The expected move comes as Federal Reserve Board Chair Ben Bernanke tries to keep inflation in check by bringing consumer spending under control. While previous increases have not had that impact, the rising rates have started to take a toll in the home industry, and we'll have more on that in a moment. But joining us on the line is Scott Lannon. He covers the Federal Reserve for Bloomberg News in Washington. And Scott, can you start by telling us what you're expecting to hear at today's announcement?
Well, it's all but certain that they're going to increase the benchmark U.S. interest rate to 5%. The question is, what exactly do they say in their statement after the meeting? How do they characterize the outlook for inflation and the economy? And how do they indicate what they're going to do at the next meeting in June and potentially thereafter?
Right, because when the Fed speaks, people listen and adjust accordingly. Getting back to the rates rising, why does that impact inflation? And I guess we have to, you know, remind ourselves what inflation is. Why would they raise these numbers? What would it do?
Well, the idea is that by raising the cost of money in the economy will help to stem inflation, and the Federal Reserve's primary goal is to make sure that inflation and inflation expectations don't get out of hand.
Because the thinking is when consumers are spending a lot of money, businesses run out of supply, so they raise the prices, and the prices continue to rise, right?
Right, and those higher prices should, in turn, then reduce people from spending more, although it doesn't necessarily happen that way if everybody's increasing prices all around, and that's the kind of situation that the Fed is trying to avoid.
So in other words, the Fed hopes to force people to stop spending as much money by raising interest rates.
Right, that's their goal.
And then when interest rates rise, consumers may spend less, and that drives the prices down because businesses will cut prices to get them to spend more. That's the thinking, right?
Yes, very well said.
Thank you. But how does this affect housing and things like mortgages?
More recently, it's tended to push up mortgage rates finally. They were very low for several years, and now they're pushing them up to the point where people are starting to buy fewer houses. We still have a pretty strong housing market, but it's obviously not as strong as it was last year, and the Fed is predicting that there will be a kind of, quote, gradual cooling in the market.
Well, here in the Boston area, we're reading about foreclosures going up 30% in Massachusetts because people who got some of those adjustable mortgages are now struggling to pay the higher interest rates.
Yes, and the Fed is trying to take that into account, the impact of people getting socked with the higher payments from those kinds of loans. They're not so sure how broad the effect is going to be, but it'll certainly have an effect in markets where that kind of borrowing has been prevalent.
We're reading here in this area about people trying to sell homes by bringing in well-known chefs to cook in the home during an opening and have things like mystery parties in the home.
Well, those are the kinds of things that would happen when there are a lot more homes on the market than there were previously, and it's becoming more of a buyer's market in the Boston area, as you mentioned, and also down here in Washington. And that's the case in other markets all over the country where the housing values have really gone up a lot, and investors are trying to sell these homes where they may have taken out adjustable loans. That is partly a function of the mortgage rates going up, which is the result of the Fed raising rates.
Can you speculate what the Fed might say and what the markets are bracing for in addition to the higher interest rate?
There's some talk that they're going to soften their language somewhat. They've been saying for many of their previous meetings that some further increase in the benchmark interest rate may be needed, but this time they could say it may or may not be needed. They may wait for more economic data. It is a major challenge to figure out how to phrase this best so the markets don't get out of hand.
How else would a slightly higher rate impact consumers?
The most immediate impact will be on people who have outstanding credit card balances or home equity lines of credit. Those are tend to be tied to the prime rate, usually set 3 points above the Fed funds rate, and that would be about 8% after today's decision. And those credit lines are usually adjustable or variable, and those would go up. And if you have a balance, you're going to be paying, your payment's going to be going up.
What about businesses?
Any businesses, again, that would take out loans might be tied to the prime rate, which could cause them to slow down spending. although the Fed is still confident that, there will be some pretty strong business spending this year. Also, on the other hand, savings rates have gone up. You see certificate of deposits paying at rates that you haven't seen in 5 years or so, and it's becoming more attractive to save more, and that's another thing that could happen.
Scott Lamman, he covers the Federal Reserve for Bloomberg News in Washington, D.C. And again, the Feds are expected today to announce a slight interest rate increase. Scott, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Is there anything left to learn from the pilgrims who came to these shores almost 400 years ago? Well, first of all, speaking as we just were about mortgages, did you know that the Indians mortgaged their land to pay off their debts to the pilgrims, and some of us are living on those foreclosures today? But there's more. According to author Nathaniel Philbrick, much more, and it can be applied to how Americans interact with unfamiliar cultures today. On the Mayflower crossing, the pilgrims didn't trust the non-pilgrims. They called them the strangers. But they were forced to survive together, cold, claustrophobic, and at the end of the voyage, out of beer, which they drank instead of the filthy water. And then the pilgrims came to Plymouth and encountered natives. Now, Nathaniel Philbrick says Americans tend to leapfrog from a lovely first Thanksgiving to the battles at Lexington and Concord 150 years later. But in between, and all but forgotten, there was a devastating war named after a Native American who called himself a king that would set the stage for the way Native Americans were ultimately treated throughout the New World. Nathaniel's new book is called Mayflower, A Story of Courage, Community, and War. And Nathaniel Philbrick joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Great to be here.
And tell us first, why go back to this story that we feel, you know, we've all cut out the little paper feathers and been the Indians or the Puritans in grade school on Thanksgiving and feel like we've heard this story? Why go back to it?
Well, you know, as a nation, we seem to need a myth of beginnings. And for many of us, it's the story of the Mayflower and the first Thanksgiving that is that iconic first step as a nation. And the more I got into the 17th century, the more I realized what we learn in elementary school really bears very little resemblance to what actually happened. And, you know, if we're going to be concerned about where we came from, I really think it's important to look at it as best we can.
Fiercely.
Fiercely, yes.
And who we came from. Tell us, first of all, tell me one thing that you thought you knew that turned out to be different once you started researching.
One of the things that astonished me was in the beginning, how much of a survival story this was from the very beginning. And, you know, these were not empire builders. These were relatively humble people who came to transplant their congregation to the new world.
Well, let's stop you right there, because the pilgrims, and I've got some as ancestors, so I can say this, they were humble, they were heroic, but they were an odd bunch. They were sort of like the fundamentalists of their day.
Yeah, they were a religious cult. Many of them had spent 12 years in Leiden, Holland, you know, a very densely packed urban center of Europe, and English exiles. And
so, remind us why.
Because they were Puritan separatists, which believed that the Church of England was the wrong church and that they had to withdraw to worship God in the right way. And, you know, they were not in search of religious freedom. They were in search of an opportunity to do it the way they thought was right.
In some ways, this kind of group of people today, with the way they moved, I mean, maybe I'm taking this a bit far, you know, but with the way they were secretive and moved about and were so isolationist, I mean, they might even have caused suspicion today.
If the pilgrims had moved into the outskirts of your town, you would have been maybe perhaps a little concerned. I mean, these people knew each other wonderfully well, and you know, every aspect of their lives was connected through this congregation. But they also had a real myopia when it came to looking beyond themselves. You see it as they're planning their voyage across the ocean. They're getting duped by financiers right and left, by government officials. Mm-hmm. And when they come to America, they're at the mercy of the Indians, who very quickly realize that, you know, these people can be used for the Native Americans' own purposes.
Right. Yeah. And one of the pilgrims, William Bradford, would write that they knew they were pilgrims.
That's the term we use, and it's based on this wonderful passage from William Bradford, whose book of Plymouth Plantation is just one of the great texts of American literature and history. And, yeah, they regarded themselves in the biblical sense as, you know, this was a passage through life to hopefully, immortality. And so what happened on this earth was just a shadow of what really counted.
Right. It's so odd, because where have we heard that, you know, before we're hearing that we hear that kind of language today? Well, but they were also tempered in their zealousness by the strangers. Who were the strangers?
Yes. It was the strangers, I think, that really saved them, saved Plymouth Colony from becoming this monolithic cult of religious extremism. The strangers were late-inning substitutes because as the progress in the negotiations went on, it was becoming clear.
You mean to get on the ship?
To get on the ship.
It was sort of like an adventure travel company that put together this group on the,
yeah,
on the
it
ship.
Was, it was a bad cruise from the very beginning. And a lot of the people in the congregation of Leiden got cold feet. And they said, well, you know, you guys go first. If you're still alive in a year, we'll follow you. And the investors said, well, we need to fill up the ranks with non-separatists. So they looked to English settlers from London, who were not Puritan separatists, and the Pilgrims called them strangers, and almost half the Mayflower was composed of non-believers, if you will. And so this, from the very beginning, forced the people we call the Pilgrims to begin to adapt, to move out of the mindset they had been in for more than a decade, to make them deal with others outside their congregation.
And by the way, you note that the Puritans had already gone into exile in Holland. So why did they need the New World?
Well, they had been in Holland for a little over a decade, and what was happening was they were working menial jobs in the cloth industry, and their health was suffering. They were working 6 days a week, literally dawn till dusk. But the most important thing was that their children were becoming Dutch, and these people were fiercely proud of their English ancestry. They didn't want this to happen. And there were other problems in Holland that was making it more and more unsafe. So they decided they couldn't go back to England. So why not go to the New World? They saw it as a kind of blank slate that they could do what they wanted to do and reclaim their English ancestry.
Let's talk about the New World that they came to. In reading this, you know, I was reminded that history tends to conflate in our minds. You know, the Puritans, yeah, they came over on the Nina and the Pinta and the Mayflower, yeah. You know, and they came and they discovered, New England. And, of course, in reading it, you know, we're reminded that there were fleets of European fishing boats here fishing for cod.
This was not the first encounter between the Europeans and Native Americans by any means. Hundreds of ships from Europe were regularly cod fishing along the coast of southern New England. Explorers had been coming for decades, and so this was not a new world. And most importantly, though, through the 3 years while the Pilgrims were preparing for this voyage, diseases from European fishermen had been ravaging the Native Americans in southern New England, killing as many as 90% in what would become the town of Plymouth. A community of between 2,000 and 3,000 Native Americans was completely gone when the Pilgrims arrived.
When the Pilgrims finally found it, they worked their way down the Cape, which sticks out in the ocean, and it's just entertaining to read their thoughts about Cape Cod. They just thought it was dune-swept and barren, all this awful place. And of course, now people pay millions of dollars to live on those same
dunes. Go out to Provincetown in late November.
Yeah, it's tough.
And go out to the end there, and it's pretty forbidding. And these were people that were 200 miles off course, and they had just pure unknown ahead of them.
Nathaniel Philbrick, his latest book is Mayflower. And when the Pilgrims do meet the Native Americans, they don't bring disease, they bring war. More ahead here now. And we're back with Nathaniel Philbrick. His new book is Mayflower, A Story of Courage, Community, and War. He tells a great story of how when the first English ships arrived on these shores years earlier than the Mayflower, the natives thought it was a walking island, you know, the mast, a tree, the sails, clouds, and they paddled out to pick strawberries off the ship. But as we just heard, by the time the Pilgrims arrived on the Mayflower in 1620, Native Americans had been nearly wiped out by European diseases. And so they played a cautious peekaboo with the terrified Pilgrims for months. Eventually, brave men on both sides, the Indian Massasoit and the Plymouth Governor William Bradford, forged a peaceful relationship that lasted over 50 years. But Nathaniel Philbrick, take us back to the first encounter between these two cultures. Didn't a near-naked Indian just walk up to the Pilgrims and say hi?
Yeah, that's Samoset. By this time, they've been at Plymouth for a number of months. It's a terrible winter. People are dying right and left. Mm. But, you know, by the spring, half of them would be dead, more than 50 people dead. And they've been seeing Indians in the shadows, so to speak. But finally, in the spring, an Indian appears on the hill across the brook from where they had created a settlement. And instead of skulking and fleeing, he walks boldly towards them. And this terrifies him because this Indian knows no fear. And he walks across the stream right up to them and says in pretty good English, "Welcome, Englishman." And, and thus it begins.
And thus it begins and goes on for 50 years, a relationship that culminates in a horrible war.
For most of us, the story of the Pilgrims ends with the first Thanksgiving. And what I wanted to do with this book is say, no, this is the beginning of the story. What really is important are this 55 years of coexistence, which is remarkable.
Just explain for us why, because as you said, I mean, there was just a handful of Puritans at this point and the strangers in this colony. The Pilgrims were propping up sick Pilgrims on trees and putting guns in their hands as a show of force, you know,
right,
to try to convey to the Indians that there were more of them than there were.
Yeah, we aren't dead yet. Yeah.
And so why didn't the Indians wipe out the Pilgrims? What did the Indians get from the Pilgrims?
Well, what Massasoit reluctantly realized is that the Pilgrims were his ticket to increasing his people's power relative to the Narragansetts. The Wampanoag had been devastated by disease, but the Narragansetts had been unaffected and were making moves to basically take over the Wampanoags. Mm. And so what Massasoit realized is if he could create an alliance with this pitiful group of English, it might be a way for him to establish some kind of parity in his portion of New England. And this alliance would work. For 55 years, there would be peaceful coexistence between these two people, and the Wampanoag would continue as an independent people.
Well, what went wrong?
Well, it was a real generational shift. That first generation realized that they needed each other. They didn't understand each other necessarily in many ways, but they realized that if things broke down, the alternative was the unthinkable, war and death. The second generation began to think that, you know, hey, we're here. On the English side, the young people began to covet the land that the Indians had, while the young Indians felt that, you know, they were in a cul-de-sac, losing land right and left. The fur trade that had helped to support the first generation of Native Americans in getting Western goods had dried up, and the only thing they had was land. And so by 1675, the tensions are building. But, you know, it wasn't inevitable. I mean, we have a tendency to say, you know, in hindsight, a war was inevitable, but that's not how the people who lived it felt it. It was a very much a surprise, and I really think it was a crisis of leadership on both sides. Philip, who was Massasoit's son, had been bobbing and weaving for about 10 years, trying to appease his increasingly restless warriors with promises of, you know, we're going to get them, and yet backing off continually, while the English, under Josiah Winslow, who was the son of Edward Winslow, were becoming increasingly arrogant. And the two of them hated each other on a very personal level. And the two of them ended up being responsible for a war that basically destroyed New England. And when you put this war in the context of the Mayflower, I think you begin to see that 17th century and the Pilgrims were not a wonderful exception to the history of America. They were, in microcosm in many ways, the history of what would be this land, our relentless push west. And it's, you know, it's something in which English and native peoples are for 55 years coexisting, but then it all falls apart. And I think it's an intriguing what might have been if there had not been war, because as I said, this war was not inevitable. What if New England going into the Revolution still had a vibrant native presence? Would there have been a different America that emerged from that revolution?
What do you dream? What do you imagine?
One of the things that intrigued me in this story was the amazingly complex bicultural community that was created during those first 50 years. You had the English adopting native food ways. You had the natives adopting so much of Western culture. I mean, it's in a country in which, you know, we pride ourselves as a melting pot, it's heartbreaking to see it completely snuffed out. Yeah. And so You never know. But for me, it was really the driving tragedy of this story is that, you know, despite all the bad things everyone did, there was this glimmer of hope, and then it was just completely destroyed.
And as you said, probably set the standard, some would say a very low one, for how America would be formed as it moved west.
Right, absolutely. I mean, after King Philip's War, there was an attitude of racist contempt to the Native Americans that had not existed in that form prior to this war. I mean, this was a war for only 14 months in which 5,000 people died of a total population of 70,000. And it was terrifying. And people emerged from this terribly shaken. What followers of Philip were not killed were shipped out as slaves to the Caribbean. If you had told me the issue of slavery would be a part of the story of the Pilgrims 15 years ago, I would have wondered. But it is part of this story, and it just makes it all the more a profoundly American story.
Hmm. Author Nathaniel Philbrick, his new book is Mayflower, A Story of Courage, Community, and War, and it's a fascinating read. And this news note that relates to tomorrow's show, Russian President Vladimir Putin delivered his 7th State of the Nation address today, focusing much of it on Russia's military future. He also referred to the United States and said, their house, meaning the U.S., is their fortress. Good for them, but that means we must also make our house strong. We'll have more on that tomorrow.
Funding for Here and Now comes.
A child facing down a bulldozer, a dove dripping blood, tanks rolling towards a wall. Young Palestinian refugees created these images for a student-organized art exhibit at Brandeis University outside of Boston here in Massachusetts. But after 4 days on display, the school shut down the exhibit, saying it was too one-sided. Brandeis is a Jewish-sponsored school, but it's non-sectarian and is considered forward-looking. It's reached out to Palestinians and has Jordan's Prince as its commencement speaker this year. The decision about the art show is the talk of the campus. Here's a sampling.
These kids are from refugee camps. This is their life, so the pictures aren't going to be children running around playing. They're going to be ugly. They're going to be what they live.
It's not really even about Israel or Palestine or anything like that as much as it's just about this free speech issue, and that's something that I'm pretty disappointed in the administration for doing.
For the Brandeis University Library, one of the most liberal campuses in the entire country, to start taking down Palestinian pictures that were too gruesome, I really must say something. I hadn't seen the pictures myself, but I would assume it's the proper decision to take down something that's just simply too offensive to hang up.
Well, you can see the pictures at our website, here-now.org. 27-year-old Lior Halperin organized the Voices from Palestine exhibit. She served in the Israeli Army and has been studying at Brandeis for the last year. Here Now art critic Bill Marks recently spoke with her and asked her response when Brandeis pulled the exhibit.
I was I'm still very much surprised by what this has created and generated. I would never expect it to be silenced like that. I thought that doesn't happen in the U.S. anymore. It was, for me, it's simple censorship, and trying to silence the Palestinian voice and the Palestinian narrative is a sin, and it will only make us stay in the situation in which we are right now.
Now, we do have a statement by Daniel Terrace, who's the director of the International Center for Ethics, Justice, and Public Life at Brandeis.
Yeah.
He has said that that the intentions behind the exhibit were excellent, but that according to him, that some members of our campus community would likely to find it troubling, and did find it troubling.
4 days after the exhibition was up, he called me and said that he feels like there's a mushroom of criticism, and that it might interfere with the university's other initiatives with Palestinian organizations, and that he suggested that I will take the exhibition down, to which I refused. That was the only response I got from the university.
Brandeis is trying to make, slowly but surely, more connections with Palestinian institutions and literary figures and so forth. And there's obviously a certain amount of, let's say, resistance to that at the university.
Absolutely. I think most of the resistance actually comes from outside and not from within the university. I'm getting amazing amounts of emails and phone calls of people who support the exhibition and the intention behind the exhibition. People do not want the university to decide for them that this is too much for them to deal with.
Now, can you tell me a little bit about the images in the exhibition, in particular those images that people found troubling?
People were mostly troubled by one painting that portrays the land of Israel with a Palestinian flag on it. which for some people was absolutely outrageous. I don't really know why. I mean, obviously, this is part of the Palestinian narrative, and why should it be silenced and forbidden? It doesn't mean that the land will be returned to Palestinians. It only means that a child at the age of 12 dreams about the land of Palestine. And also there were paintings about one child, her name is Ola, she painted Rachel Corrie in her image. Rachel Corrie is dead and there's an Israeli tank.
We should remind people, Rachel Corrie was a young American activist who was killed by an Israeli bulldozer in Gaza. Israel says it was an accident. Corrie supporters say it was deliberate.
Now, people were asking, what is this? This is outrageous. Yes, this is outrageous, but this is an image of something that actually happened. And this is an image that was hunting this child. And when she was asked to portray something from her life, that's the image that is in her mind, and it's in her soul. So what do we do if we silence that?
Another controversy at Brandeis is that playwright Tony Kushner has been invited to receive an honorary doctorate at the university. And this decision has come under fire because Kushner has been a critic of the way Israel deals with Palestinians. And this has somehow been lumped into what's happened to you and your exhibit.
Generally, it's pretty much coming from the same people who are trying to maintain the same kind of one-dimensional way in which Brandeis is treating the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is just absolutely ignoring the Palestinian side, as if Palestinians are non-existent.
And now I understand you're leaving the university.
Indeed.
Now, this was as planned. Are you leaving because of this incident? And what do you take from this incident and from the university as you leave?
I'm not leaving because of this incident. I'm leaving because I've realized after a few months in the U.S. that my community is in Israel and Palestine, and that's the only home I have. That's the only place where I feel like I'm powerful and valuable. So this is why I'm going back home.
Lior Halperin, presenter of the exhibit Voices of Palestine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We now turn to Daniel Terrace. He's director of the International Ethics Center at Brandeis University. Daniel, now, Lior Halperin told us that you called her to ask her to take down the exhibit, but she refused and it was pulled anyway. I mean, was this a rash decision on your part?
I made a phone call to her because I was concerned about the particular form and content of her exhibit, the relative lack of context. I was actually concerned that the particular form of the exhibit actually threatened to create the perception that these young people were more the creatures of Palestinian propaganda than they were the kind of full people that Lior was trying to project.
Now, we've recently had on our show Palestinian students from Al-Quds University in the West Bank, and it's part of an exchange program. Now, I mean, are you concerned that what's happened with Lior's exhibit in some way is going to overshadow attempts to sort of a Brandeis to reach out to a Palestinian educational institutions and intellectuals?
My experience actually in the conversations I had the last week is that my Palestinian colleagues actually understand better than many other people the challenge of trying to move forward and take courageous steps towards building relationships for peace on the one hand, and on the other hand, some forms of institutional caution. Lior's claim that Brandeis somehow silences Palestinian voices is just simply transparently false. Over the last several years, universities made an enormous effort to bring prominent Palestinians into its new Center for Middle East Studies, the Al-Quds University partnership. We've made big efforts for recruiting for students in that region. The notion that somehow Palestinian voices have been silenced here on our campus, I think, just doesn't hold up.
I mean, do you feel that this sort of revealed a sort of weakness or, a lack of sensitivity in dealing with issues like this on the campus?
Look, I think it's no secret that American universities have been dealing with the inherent tension between freedom of expression on the one hand and the interest of the university in protecting the educational fabric of the institution on the other, in minimizing some forms of expression that are disruptive or dangerous to that fabric. Again, it's not to say the university made the right decision in this case, but simply to say that this tension is something that is part of the fabric of American higher education.
Daniel Terrace, director of the International Ethics Center at Brandeis University, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
That piece from Here Now's Bill Marks. And this note, another school, MIT, is now showing the exhibit Voices from Palestine if you're in the area. If you're not, you can see the artwork at here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Geronimo. Just about every American knows the name. He was the elusive Apache who fiercely fought American forces till he could hold them off no more. He converted to Christianity, marched in Teddy Roosevelt's inaugural parade, before dying in 1909. He was buried at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. May he rest in peace. But maybe he didn't. For years, there have been rumors that the skull of the Apache warrior Geronimo was dug up by members of Skull and Bones, the elite secret society at Yale University, whose members have included John Kerry, William F. Buckley, and several generations of the Bush family. In fact, Prescott Bush, grandfather to the current president, father to the first, is said to be one of the grave raiders. Well, now a writer in New Haven, Connecticut, has unearthed new evidence that seems to lend support to the rumors. And that writer, Mark Wortman, joins us now. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Skull and Bones, you know, we heard a lot of talk about it during the last presidential election because both candidates had been members. But is the group known to collect skulls?
It is rumored that they have a collection of various skulls and bones, you know, some of which are rumored to be the skulls of famous people. There was one rumor that they have Pancho Villa's, and of course the most enduring rumor seems to be that they had taken Geronimo's skull and some other bones and material from his grave.
And just let's remind ourselves, Geronimo, the Apache leader, the last Native American to resist giving up land to American settlers, how is he viewed by Apaches today?
My understanding is that he is still revered. There are still family members living on a reservation in Arizona, and he remains an iconic figure, not just among the Native Americans, but I think among all Americans, right, because of his fierce reputation as a warrior.
And also then his, you know, after he surrendered, he became quite a public figure as well. And we hear that Native Americans actually buried some of their revered leaders in places that remain hidden just so that grave robbers couldn't get to the graves. And they absolutely believe this rumor. Well, tell us, what have you found that might lend some credence to it?
In the process of researching a book about a group of Yale students who got together and formed a campus flying club that became the first squadron in the Navy Air Reserve, the papers of the man who founded the group, Frederick Truby Davison, are at the Yale Library. So one of the members of Skull and Bones was based in New Haven. He wrote to Truby in a letter that I came across. He wrote, "The skull of the worthy Geronimo the Terrible, exhumed from its tomb at Fort Sill by your club, is now safe inside the tomb together with his well-worn femurs, bit, and saddle horn."
What does that say to you? It would seem to me to be proof that Geronimo was dug up by Skull and Bones.
It certainly seems to be that pretty clear documentary evidence. However, we do need to keep in mind that historians who've looked into the matter say that it would have been very difficult to know which grave exactly was Geronimo. Precisely for the reasons that you mentioned earlier, his grave may have been unmarked, the body may have been shifted to other graves.
In fact, there are historians at Fort Sill who say that, in fact, his grave was not disturbed.
Yeah, but they, too, wouldn't have known which was the grave.
Right.
Clearly, what the letter indicates is they dug up a grave, they thought it was Geronimo's, they took his skull and femurs and some horse tack and brought it back to New Haven.
Right. So even if it's not true that it was Geronimo, you know, we understand, even though it's a very secretive group, they meet in this windowless building known as the Tomb.
Mm-hmm.
There's art celebrating death all on the walls.
Mm-hmm.
And then you add this to it, that they were running around digging up graves that they thought were graves of Geronimo. Why? Sounds like a silly thing for people who are going to be future leaders of America.
Yeah. Well, it's very ritualistic. There's no question about that. If it wasn't so gruesome, you'd just say, okay, let's, you know, boys will be boys.
Let rich boys be rich boys.
Yeah. But there, you know, to me, the bottom line is this is somebody's ancestor. You know, if it was my ancestor, I'd be really, really upset to think that they had robbed his grave.
Author Mark Wortman about new evidence he's discovered, a letter that possibly links the remains of Geronimo to the Yale Secret Society Skull and Bones. Mark is also author of the new book, The Millionaires Unit, The Aristocratic Flyboys Who Fought the Great War and Invented American Air Power. He's been speaking to us from Connecticut. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Now. So you say you can't find anything new and exciting to listen to, and on the rare occasion when you hear something cool like this on commercial radio, they don't tell you what it is? It's Jerry. Too bad. You don't have my longtime friend and personal music consultant, Stephen. Well, wait a minute. Today you do. Stephen Cantor is host of Beats and Pieces on Oregon Public Broadcasting Radio, and we thought we'd check in with him and find out what's on Stephen's iPod. Always a wide range of new music to open the ears and the mind. Stephen, welcome.
Hi there.
So what are we hearing, and how does this relate to your theme for today?
Well, actually, this is probably the song that I've plagued my listeners with more than any over the course of the past year. My show tends to operate on a different principle. The idea is to not play the same song many times, but to play lots of different things. And so I always hesitate to repeat tunes. But this one, I just find completely irresistible. It's a song by a duo. They add other musicians, called Brotherly from the UK, actually a husband and wife team. And it's got all the sort of great elements of pop songs, so the great hook, incredible beat, although everything is a little bit different and a little bit altered, and it really makes you pay attention.
Right, and it brings you to the question of the hour. What the heck is this? I mean, the song is called A Little Trouble, but beyond that, what genre is it?
Well, I brought a bunch of tunes today that... I like to pick out songs that make me sort of say what's going on here, and maybe perhaps more specifically in this case, this is clearly a piece of sort of dance music, but it's very different from most dance music that I'm used to listening to. Much more sophisticated harmonic and melodic material, these sort of vaguely threatening, dangerous sounding lyrics, and just this beat that I just can't resist.
Well, and there's a lot more that you have to follow. Let's introduce our next artist that provokes that question. What is this? Who have you got?
This is a piano player and composer also from the UK. His name is Django Bates. He's a jazz piano player, but again, in this piece you'll hear, first of all, it's sort of a jazz rhythm section with a singer, and it's clearly a song, and it's not just reinterpreting a standard. It's an original song. But there's also a string quartet that's an integral part of the tune. Very interesting beats. And one thing which I particularly was drawn to in this one is Django Bates actually uses humor pretty frequently in his music. And that's a very difficult thing to do. Most of the time, when you hear humor in music, it's in the realm of the novelty tune. This one is actually just sort of whimsical, and it just makes you smile.
Django Bates, you live and learn, apparently.
7/9 of 63. What Mrs. Duff taught me. She drummed it into my little brain, and I use it regularly. You live and learn. Though it might seem obvious, for some it was hard to cross. That cows shouldn't eat cows' brains, they were meant to live on grass. You live and learn.
Stevie went on his website, and is it true that as a young man, Django Bates traveled across Europe with his parents, and at one point Romanian gypsies gave the family a wooden mug full of warm, frothy milk?
You know, I wasn't aware of that particular detail of his biography, but maybe I'll have to do some more research.
Okay. And now we have some soul music and an artist that's also not so easy to peg.
It brings up the idea of perspective. For example, if you look at Slonimsky's book on musical invective, where he's collected criticisms over the years, and you find critics in the 19th century slamming Beethoven and calling him an idiot. And then here we are 200 years later. and Beethoven's a genius. Well, it seems to me it's reasonable to assume that we will have a similar lack of perspective on our own recent history. Hip-hop culture has been a really great thing for music in a way that I don't think lots of people talk about. The whole idea of sampling and people going back and revisiting records from the 70s and 80s and finding really amazing things, which at the time the critics tended to dismiss. In this case, I'm thinking of a whole realm of jazz records, mostly just dissed at the time. It's not real jazz, or, you know, it's just pop music. And now people, young people, are going back, finding this music and revisiting it and finding lots of treasures. Mm-hmm. And now really sort of being lifted to a very high level of almost reverence. Now, in this case, we have this man, Mark DeClive-Low. He's a piano player, but clearly influenced by hip-hop culture and also revisiting these tunes from the 70s, very much influenced by Herbie Hancock's recording from the 70s, using contemporary production. This is basically soul music, but it sounds very different from any other soul music that I've heard.
Mark DeClive-Low, quintessential. Okay, Mark DeClive-Low, the song is quintessential. And by the way, we're going to have all the tunes we're hearing from Steven's iPod at our website. We'll let you know how to get there. Well, what would Steven's iPod be without a Brazilian tune? And we've got one.
Yeah, but this is a pretty weird one. It's almost like you need a scorecard to keep track of how this one comes about. First of all, this is a song that was, a hit for Roberto Carlos in the 60s in Brazil. And it's got that sort of Tropicália kind of music from the 60s where they're bringing in elements of U.S. pop and rock and sort of mixing it with vaguely bossa nova-like rhythms. But this song was actually written by John D. Loudermilk, the guy who wrote Tobacco Road. It was called Roadhog. And it sounded to me like basically John D. Loudermilk listened to Tequila. You know, it's got that ka-ding-a-ding, ka-ding-a-ding, ka-ding-a-ding. That's the basic groove. Then Roberto Carlos writes Brazilian lyrics to it called Ucalium Becky, which I think means roadhog. But now what we have is this version where it's been remixed by a guy named DJ Xerxes, or XRS, he refers to himself. So you have this thing where, okay, there's this American tune that gets picked up by a Brazilian guy in the 60s and sort of Brazilified and now remixed, but not using Brazilian beats, using this sort of raga drum and bass drawn from hip-hop beats that were very popular in the UK in the 80s and 90s.
You know, Stephen, I think I hear a little Roadrunner in there, too. Falavam que estouro, que beleza de carrinho. E fui me acostumando e do carango fui gostando. Calhandec, bibi, quero conservar o calhandec. The most interesting thing about all these pieces to me that we've described is they all involve different sort of traditional stylistic boundaries just collapsing. They're just collapsing. Interestingly, it's not that these pieces don't have identity. I think they all have quite distinct identities. But they're not like, oh, you can peg this as this is Brazilian music or this is jazz or this is from Armenia or any of that. And I think it's a very exciting time in music for precisely that reason. Stephen Cantor, my personal musical consultant and also host of Beats and Pieces on Oregon Public Broadcasting Radio. You can find out more about his show and the music you just heard on our website, here-now.org. Stephen, thanks so much.
I don't need to tell you, Robin, it's such a pleasure to speak with you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young.